Get going.
I know five. I tend to be very sharp, but okay, I can put up with people coming later. That's okay. Okay, so just as a way of an introduction, I'm Luis Lehner. I'm in Office 328. So this course is, as you know, general relativity. Different people have been teaching this in different ways, their own styles, their own goals. My goal will be to give you rather focused set of topics that are sufficiently, I think, self-contained and giving you the fundamentals of how you build a theory, how you work with a theory, so that in case in the future or whatever in the near future, you want to learn even more, you can pick it up as you go. Of course, you can always ask me. I mean, one fact about general relativity is at the classical level, it is a well-defined subject. There are plenty of books that fit whoever's style. I will mainly be following these two books, which I like. So one is General Relativity by Bob Wald, A Tower of the Field. And another one is An Introduction to General Relativity by Sean Carroll. In many respects, and maybe I shouldn't be saying this, and hopefully it's not going to be recorded, but I know it will be. In many respects, to me, they are the same book. If you actually open the indices of both books, they are one-to-one correspondent. And you could regard Carroll's book as a smoother, more gentle way into general relativity than Bob's than Wald's book. It has more examples. It's a bit more lenient on the reader, depending on what your background might be. You may find going first this way and then kind of following with Wald's book, or vice versa. If you find Wald's book is more kind of formal, more mathematical, and it has several examples, but if you want an expansion on those, you can always pick and follow the parallel discussion in Carroll's. These two, even though this is called an introduction, because as I said, it follows quite a bit Wald's book, they are a slightly higher level than many of the other books you could find. Like there's Jim Hartle's book, Bernard Schultz's books, Eric Poisson's. Especially these two are more introductory books. I suggest you might want to take a look at them. And Poisson is more of a computational book in the sense that it has plenty of examples. This is how you work with a theory. This is how you get results done. And of course, Poisson is a neighbor. Eric Poisson is a professor at the University of Guelph, and he usually comes to the building as well. So you may get to interact with him. Another useful book, and I saw in the library there are at least a couple of copies. There is something called a Problem Book in General Relativity by Lyman Press. Prize. There are several authors. And this was a group of people working, students working or studying Caltech general relativity under the direction of Kip Thorne. So one day they got together and they just wrote a whole bunch of books and their solutions. It's actually pretty useful. The notation is awful in that, okay, it's a notation of the 70s. So you need to kind of gather yourself with strength to read it. But it has lots of really cool things. And another book that I haven't put it here is the Book of Gravitation by Mr. Thorne and Whittier. There's a book this big. You can use it to do exercises. I mean, physical exercises, a really heavy book. It has a very outdated notation, but it's full of interesting physics. So I also recommend you taking a look at that book. And if you find what you're looking for, it's great because it will be very rich in description. Every time I open that book, I find the last thing I was looking for the previous time I opened it. Never find what I want to look, but I always end up reading and having a good time in what they were discussing. And it covers everything. So I suggest you also, if you're interested in general relativity, every now and then taking that book is very useful. So someone was pointing out the material is not necessarily up. I'll check why, but there is one reason I know some material is not there. So this is my first time teaching this book here in Tsai, so I don't have pre-written notes. One of you contacted me during the weekend And I said, look, I don't have the notes. I'm going to be working with you as we go along. But you have access to last year's course taught by David Kubisnak, who you know very well now. So it, by and large, the content will be the same, except with a few differences later in the course. As we go now, I'm actually flipping the order. He would cover first the Einstein equation and then go into manifold. I prefer to do the opposite. I prefer to lay down the mathematical foundation first, and then we transition into Einstein's equation. But the content would be the same. Of course, the examples might differ, but by and large, you can take a look at that as well. Okay. I said I will have office hours, I would say from 1 to 2 p.m. My office, you can knock there whenever you want. But I hope you try that time, because it's always useful to have more than one person. You might find that some of the questions you're asking or you were thinking, someone else has also thought about it, or someone else is asking things that you have yet realized that, oh, that's a question I wanted to ask. And then the other thing I was suggesting, or I was thinking that it might be a good idea on Fridays in a much more relaxed setting. So I will hang around in the second floor bistro. So if you pick your food and just come up, we can just chat, discuss anything about the course. So let's try today to discuss some of these, at least hopefully most of these, but we'll see as we go along, which is kind of the background kind of things we need to discuss to say, well, we need to do something. If we want to keep doing gravitation, or we want to study gravity, there are a lot of things that we have been relying up to kind of the late 1800s that we have to give up. So I'm sure you're all familiar with special relativity, so I'm not going to go into it in any details. Every now and then it will come up. I must admit, I always got confused with special relativity. To me, general relativity kind of cleans up all the concepts, and so I'd rather start with general relativity, and when needed, we go to special relativity. But special relativity, Einstein kind of formulated in the early 1900s to try and make sense of symmetries that were coming out by both tested with experiments, the Michelson-Morley experiment, and the symmetries of electrodynamics. So something had to give, and so Galilean invariance was thrown out of the window, and special relativity comes in. And then it takes about 11 years to present his equation. So something happened, something radical had to kind of come into his head, and at the same time, having kind of realized some of the choices he had to make, he had to go and learn mathematics. He had to go and learn new mathematics that was required to actually build this intuition that he had into some formal expression for what the theory that replaces, say, Newton's gravitation should be. So let's just kind of revisit some of those things and slowly build into our notion where we should be going. So let's just start with a few observations. And the first one, and this is why I said the principle of equivalence, the principles in plural of equivalence. So let's start with the first one. First one is fairly obvious, though we perhaps didn't think about it as we were learning even Newtonian theory. So Newton's second law. Says F equal ma, right? And I'm being very sloppy with the notation because we just want to establish some concepts. And this thing was something weird. It was that thing, that constant of proportionality, that told us given a force what the acceleration of the object would be. And this is very weird in the sense that we have only one equation and two unknowns, the force and the mass. But be that as it may, this is the inertial mass. So this is that mass or that quantity that tells us this relation. What's the acceleration of an object would be that has that mass being acted of a force, by a force. But Newton's law of gravitation also told us that that force is given by m minus m, let's call it g, the gradient of a potential. So given a potential, if you want, given an acceleration, the force, now this is the force of gravity, is given by that constant of proportionality. And there is no reason a priori why these two masses, these two constants should be the same. But kind of Galileo studied this, and to the extent that his experiments were able to prove, then you had mg equal mi. And till present, people have kept going at this, just making more and more accurate measurements on these stats. And so then, out of here, you say, well, the acceleration is given by the gradient of the potential, and it's independent of the mass. Any object, regardless of its mass, will feel the same acceleration in the same gravitational field. Of course, that is only true if the object we're talking about is not so strongly affecting its surrounding that we can consider this is just a test particle. So a test particle or a particle, whenever we use that terminology, we mean it's an object that is there not affecting its surrounding. So the gravitational pull of the particle itself is not changing in any way the gravitational field. But as far as that is concerned, if we're talking about particles, we're saying there is a universal law of gravitation or a universal effect of gravitation which says the acceleration will be independent of the mass. So that's observation number one, and this is sometimes referred to as the weak equivalence principle. And weak will become clear in a bit when we're going to introduce a stronger equivalence principle, or a stronger sense of equivalence, and this is why it's called, a different terminology will be used. The other one, and this is something you might have seen in the past, is the fact that, and it's also referred to here, given that we have this relation that the acceleration and the gravitational field, the gradient of gravitational field are the same regardless of what mass they're considering, we couldn't distinguish, if we were doing physics in a closed box, if that box is kind of sitting on the surface of the Earth, okay, we have an acceleration given by g. But if we have the same box or in a that is accelerated downwards with acceleration a, where a and g have the same value, we wouldn't be able to tell the difference. The experiments will give us exactly the same results. So this is where kind of the relativism starts showing up. How do we distinguish either something where it's feeling the effects of a gravitational field that induces some acceleration, then some net acceleration, or an object that is falling at that very same acceleration, or is being accelerated for whatever reason with the same strength? So,
acceleration right as compared to the gravitational field?
Say again?
The other opposite direction.
Well, if I'm just trying to imagine, so it's have this object that is falling, and then we're forcing that object to fall this way.
Because the gravitational field is in the...
Yeah, if you want to, okay, put it this way. Of course, one important distinction here is that these experiments have to all be local. Tidal forces will change this picture. And this is something that we're going to connect with in a bit when we try and define some special frames. So again, the weak equivalent principle will say in a small enough region, we can't tell the difference between one or the other one by local experiments. The experiments will give us the same results regardless. And so then these kind of led Einstein to formulate its kind of reformulation of the equivalence principle. It's called the Einstein equivalence principle. And he has to form the Einstein equivalence principle and then the strong equivalence principle. And one says what we just said in words, there are no physical experiment involving any particular force will be able to tell apart, or he said in a different way, sufficiently locally all interactions are as in special relativity. And the strong is here is except perhaps gravity. And the strong version is including gravity. So that is very locally, we're able to use, of course, this had to be natural. Very locally, we should be able to do the physics we know and love. But globally, we have to start discussing more a richer potential effect. So now, I mean, once you put all this together, you have to start arguing or thinking about what are we going to give up? Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I'm a bit confused. So we said the weak equivalence principle was that, you know, you can't really tell, or that gravitational mass is equal to inertial mass, and you can't tell if you're in a gravitational field or
you're accelerated.
How is that the same as saying all interactions are basically described by special relativity?
So first, because it could, in the background, you could imagine that there could be an interaction between the, let's say, electromagnetism. Suppose you're trying to measure the force in between two particles that are charged. You say, well, maybe there is a connection, there is an interaction with the acceleration or with the gravitational field. But you cannot distinguish these two. So if either you say, well, there is an interaction with gravity, it depends on the acceleration of the system, then you should also be able to see it in the case of the objects falling on Earth. We do our experiments and you don't see that, then you're going to postulate that. But first is a postulate. You're going to run with this. You're going to determine or build your model, and then you're going to put it to test. And it may or may not be consistent with observation. Here is for all forces, for all potential interactions, with the exception of gravity, you're going to say, I should not be able to tell whether I'm accelerated or not.
And following that up, what would there be the relation between the Einstein equivalence principle and the weak equivalence principle? Does one imply the other? Is one subsumed?
It comes from it. So it's motivated by that. So here you say, well, remember how we went. The fact that these two were the same, you said, well, I can't tell acceleration from a field. And so now I'm saying if I cannot tell those apart, and I have built all my physical models kind of in the field of Earth, I shouldn't be able to kind of explore what the acceleration should be in any possible way, and therefore I land in here. So this is just kind of a series of logical steps that you keep pushing the argument to kind of its ultimate consequence, and then you say, I have to build something that respects that. Another thing that we give up is this one. Because now we're saying, well, acceleration doesn't have a special meaning, so I don't have force. And if I don't have forces, how do I build dynamics? So I need to do something. However, we kind of establish that at least locally, there are these now special frame or special trajectories. Which are these trajectories that particles follow if accelerated or in the presence of a gravitational field. So if I have a gravitational field, I see how that particle falls, I follow its trajectory, and say that's a special. That's going to be universal. It wouldn't depend on the mass of that particle. So slowly, what we are trying to, or you're building up from, is that there are these special trajectories, which are universal in the sense that do not depend on the mass that you're discussing or the object that you're discussing, and you're going to try and build something with this. And now you face, I mean, if you are happy with that, you face another problem, because we keep talking about mass, but special relativity says mass is not special. Right, from E equal mc squared, energy and mass are interchangeable. So what do we do? Well, the question is, what is the framework where we're going to try to do something special with trajectory, which where we're not going to try to put any particular emphasis on the masses, and where we're going to try and recover locally all the physics that we know. This is where we are. That's where we're going.
Okay, I'm still confused on the difference between the weak and the strong equivalence principles. So in the weak equivalence principle, you said that locally all interactions are the same as special relativity. But the evidence that you cited for that was the equivalence of in an infinitesimally small box, accelerated or being in the gravitational field. But there you said, well, the interactions are the same if we exclude gravity.
Right.
And then, but the evidence we used was the equivalence of gravitational field with acceleration.
Right. So, okay, let me give you an example. Maybe that will be, suppose you have some gravitational field, you put a particle there, and then you see it fall. Right? It's local. But now imagine that very same particle has a little bit of structure. It's an atom now.
Yeah.
That is feeling both electromagnetic interactions and maybe nuclear and weak forces, and now you put it in the same. It need not have to be the case that these two objects fall in the same rate. So the weak says here, if you ignore any internal structure of the object, it will fall a particular way. The strong says even if you account for that, it will fall in the same way. There are, however, versions or extensions or alternative theories to Einstein's equations, to Einstein's theory of relativity, where these two fall at different rates.
So the tidal forces don't affect. Yeah. So if we assume that the center of mass is a thing, basically what the strong equivalence principle is saying is that you just look at the center of mass, assuming no structure, and it falls the same way.
Yeah. If you want to think it that way, it's like if you add any other interaction in there, but it's sufficiently local, it play a subleading role. To leading order, these two will fall exactly the same way. And we're going to describe, once we have a little bit more tools, some examples of that.
One last remark about, is this also related to self-interactions? I don't know why I have that idea that it's also related to the mass particle not self-interacting with its own.
Yeah,
okay, so that's a different thing. So the self-interaction will back react on the space-time and make something, and of course then it would be natural to expect that these two may do something different. But here is to say, no, if just imagine that there is a coupling between, say, the gravitational interaction and the other interactions holding together the object that will affect the dynamic. And again, this is something that is very extensively tested, at least in some of these theories, in, say, pulsar measurements or nowadays gravitational waves. So let's do one other kind of example that will motivate in the direction that we have to go. Suppose you have two rockets. This is my best impression of the rocket. Let's imagine they're both separated by a distance z. And let's set them both to be accelerating at exactly the same rate. And of course, we're going to do this sufficiently close together so that we're discussing leading order effects here. So now at t0, this rocket sends a photon in that direction, and in the other rocket, there is someone that will catch it. So at t1, the photon reaches the detector in the first rocket, and you measure something. So imagine here the rocket, send it with wavelength lambda 0. Associated with that lambda 0, there is a frequency. We're going to do a Doppler shift calculation. This one, well, might be different. Let's entertain that it is different. And we can we can conclude that it will be different. Why? Because from the time this one sent the photon to the time this one received it, because they are accelerated, these objects are moving at a faster speed. So we might have started send this photon with, from that rocket at velocity v, but it arrives to our detector at velocity v prime. Right? It takes some time for this one to get there. Both rockets are accelerated, so this one is moving faster. So as a result, I'm going to measure a redshifted frequency. Is that clear?
Wait, sorry. So the A there—they're both accelerating.
They're both accelerating at exactly the same acceleration.
The same rate, and you're saying the photon leaves at.
We send the photon here, and the rockets at this—they both started at the same speed, at the same velocity. Imagine they both started at zero velocity. We started acceleration. At some point, you decide to send the photon, and they're at that time t zero, both are moving at v.
You're saying the rockets are moving at, okay, I thought you meant the photon was moving at.
No, so the rocket is, initially they're moving at V. Once the photon is received, they are moving at V prime. And that will create a redshift. So we can do the calculation. So the velocity difference, let's imagine this even started at rest, will be given by the acceleration times the delta time, the interval of time between emission and reception. And this goes like A, the Z divided by C, because we're assuming that the initial separation was Z, or the separation at the time at which the first photon was submitted was Z. And because you're moving at the same acceleration, that distance gets to be constant. So now, just a standard Doppler calculation will tell us that the change in wavelength with respect to the initial wavelength of the photon is given by the change in velocity over c, which is a z over c squared. So now what we have argued is that there is an observable consequence of in the frequency of or in the wavelength of a photon because these objects are accelerated. But now, using what we just discussed, we cannot escape the fact that, well, we can replace the acceleration by some constant gravitational field. So the same thing would happen if you imagine that you're on Earth. You have a tower. You have a photon you send from there. You have a detector here. It gets received there. And there would be an associated Doppler shift. Which is now AG Z over C squared. And I'm putting G so that, okay, this is the one associated to the fact that we're in a gravitational field. And this has been, of course, measured a long time ago. And you can write it also. Okay, this is, however, a little change in height. So we could have been here, it could have been differentially closed. So we can replace this one also by. The acceleration is the gradient of the potential, and Z is that small displacement. So we can turn this into kind of a differential expression that says this is 1 over C squared right? So here I just said, well, the acceleration, and I'm being sloppy with signs, the acceleration is the gradient of the potential, and the Z is a small displacement, call it dz. And if we want to say, well, from here to over there, it has to be the integral over that dz. But this is nothing but the integral of the differential of phi, which is delta phi. So what we're saying is there is a gravitational redshift. We didn't have to think of rockets sending or whatever moving, just the fact that we're doing these experiments in the gravitational field at two different locations tells us there will be a difference between the frequency emitted and the frequency observed. And we're slowly building into something that eventually we're going to have to account for. We're going to be saying that relations between different locations at different time will be sensitive to changes in the gravitational field. This is how we're going to build in physical information into what eventually we're going to use to replace forces, which will be a metric.
Is it, if you replace the formula for Doppler shift with the special relativity case, would that give us a good answer? By good, I mean, would that also be, so if we made our experiments more accurate, would we get the result that is equivalent to the special relativity, or is there something else going on here?
Okay, so good question. One thing we're going to do, or let me just maybe say it now, one thing you did in special relativity was to say there is a way to define a global coordinate system by clocks and rods. So I can be an observer, and I have no problem whatsoever to say that what's the time that is ticking with respect to me. You, if you're moving, will be different in that hockey stick over there. GR will tell you you cannot do that anymore. The only thing you can do is locally. So as you're trying to do things at larger distances, that's out of the question.
So that was basically my problem. So we're using the classical version. That also shouldn't work.
What we're saying in GR is we can only do these kind of things if we're sufficiently local and we're going to make contact. Yes, you can use, and people have done, to try to say, how can I build further physics in special relativity by accounting for other effects? But let's just bite the bullet, motivate kind of the basic ingredients we have to have, and then just to go all the way to the end.
But if the two rockets were close enough, if the Z was really small, say the locally Minkowskian, and we put a...
Sure, absolutely.
And then write the special little...
Yes, you can do that. Yeah.
Would that give us more accurate results?
We'll give you more accurate result for that experiment, but we're trying to do something global.
Right. You can't take the integration?
No, because the moment you go further and further distance, you have to add further corrections.
Yeah.
And then you have to argue that you could sum them up to give the correct result. You don't know if that's an asymptotic series or what.
Well, my problem is with, I don't know how correct this result is.
We're not going to use it explicitly. We're motivating where we need to go, and then we're going to come down with what the final result is. So this is already telling us, look, there is some effect. But before, we would have assigned it just to a relative motion, if you want, of observer and emission and observation. Here we're saying, well, but a phenomenon like that also comes out on the gravitational field. It's by just the gravitational field itself, so we need to start building a richer structure. So, and that's where we'll go. And associated to that would be, well, if we try and do kind of a special relativistic kind of interpretation of this in terms of, say, a coordinate system, we could have imagined we have time going this way. This is set. Okay, you set for this coordinate. So we have a kind of the surface of the Earth. So let's call it C0, set 0, and this set 1 is where we observe. Maybe we emit from here to there. This delta t 0, and we observe from here to there. This delta t 1. If we just say, well, maybe this photon went straight this way and also that way, we would conclude that delta t 0 and delta t 1 are the same. But that would be inconsistent with our result. And so what we're going to be saying is part of the kind of way to reconcile these results is to say, well, no, this assumption was incorrect, that this just go straight up, that there will be some curve. If we build some curvature here, we may be able to turn this into something whose length is different. So this is also why we are going to say we need further structure, and that structure would be a curved spacetime. So curvature will do that. So we want to go here. But for that, we need a lot more math than you might have seen so far. So we need to now build our intuition on a space-time or a sandbox or an arena where we're going to write our equations or our physics that now kind of takes into account that maybe distances at some location may be different from distances at that location, even though the event might have been the same with respect to kind of some physical argument. The problem when we go here is that you give up a lot of what you know and love. For instance, triangles do not have to have their internal angles adding up to 180. Let's just do a very simple example. Let's consider a sphere. Let's take the North Pole. Imagine what this is, Greenwich. This is the line going through Greenwich, and this one is an arc line that goes at 90 degrees, but they meet the equator at 90 degrees here and there. Okay, so the addition is 270. So just by considering now a triangle that is drawn on a curves on a curve manifold, and I still haven't defined you for you what the manifold is on a curve object, you gave up the sum of internal angles in the triangle is 180. You also, well, give up at other things, like the definition of pi. One of them is just to say, well, it's the circumference over diameter. And do the same thing with the sphere. So the circumference of the sphere that has, say, radius r is 2 pi r. But the diameter, so if I now see this, would be pi r, which means that pi is now 2. So now we need the tools to even begin talking about mathematics in the presence of a possible curve background. And of course, you can make, depending on how you curve this, you can make quote unquote pi be whatever value you want, either above 3.14, blah, 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 or below. It's up to you, depending on how you curve it, where it's hyperbola or an elliptic. And there's something that was laid down by Gauss and collaborators and followers, and where Einstein had to immerse himself for a good part of a decade to try and learn how to do physics with this. And the story is that Marcel Grossman was one of his friends, and those collaborators that basically taught him or helped him learn this. So what do we want to do? Well, we want to do the same kind of thing. So in physics, we're used to displacements, we're used to trying to assign rates of changes, vectors, strength of interactions. So, and that we build over assuming that our space-time was, say, R4, if we're in special relativity doing physics in our usually accessible dimensions. And R4 was something that had coordinates, let's say, x1, x4. Very soon, I promise, we're going to start counting from zero. I prefer counting from zero. But for time being, imagine we're thinking also in n-dimensional spacetime. Some of you might want to think about string theory, and that is much larger than 4. But let's say go from x1 to xn. And under that assumption, and that the distances between points were just given by, say, the analog or the proper Pythagoras kind of distance computation, in Rn, we want to kind of go into that, but now in a potentially curved background. So we need to introduce all the things we know and love here, vectors, differentiations, rate of changes, etc., but now in a potentially curved space then. So a manifold. So for that, we're going to introduce the concept is known as a manifold, which in a way, if you want, is a cheat, would be a way to try and get a surface or a space that is curved, but try and map as many concepts as we can from here into these at the expense of perhaps just doing it locally in small patches. And in those patches, we're going to go at the end of the day back to Rn, do things there, and come back. So we're going to go up and down on that quite a bit. And this is what we're going to work out today and sometime tomorrow or the next class. So a manifold will be, let's just first do it in an informal way, and then we're going to formalize all this, is the space, which of course may or may not be curved, but we're thinking will be curved, space that it consists or can be regarded as a collection of arches that look locally as Rn, and these patches are smoothly sewn together. So this is the informal definition. And while intuitively you could imagine what and how these things make sense, like what does it mean to look locally as Rn, and what does it mean to be smoothly patched together or smoothly sewn together, this is what we're going to try and make formal now. So far, so good? So we're going to start with a concept of a map. Again, things are some of the things you're probably familiar with already. So map phi from a set M to N, where M is what, so it's a set, it's a collection of things, and N is another collection of things, and then we're using this map, which is a relation that assigns some, or maybe all, members of M, some, or maybe all members of N. And we want to describe them in as rigorous as a way as we can. So this map, we're also going to consider compositions of maps. So suppose we have phi that goes from A to B, set A to set B, another psi that goes from B to C. We can consider the map, I don't know, what's another Greek letter? Z that goes from A to C by doing what? So let's consider A, B, and C. We had phi that took us from here to there. We had psi that took us from here to there. And if we want to consider this, that map will be the map C, will be defined by phi composed with psi. All right, so first, this one takes an element of A into an element of B, but then takes an element of B and C. So this composition is a map from A to C. So maps can be, let me erase here. We're going to also require some particular properties of these maps. And again, this we keep thinking that eventually we want to use these things so that we do an identification, at least locally, of any piece of our space into Rn. And if we do that, we're going to be able to introduce or make contact with derivatives and things like we want to have in order to build our framework. So a map can be one-to-one. That if we're going, if each element of N has at most one of M that takes it to it through the map. And a map can be surjective or onto. And this is one-to-one or injective. So if each element of N has at most one element of M that is mapped onto.
Wait, sorry, are you saying a one-to-one mapping is injective? Isn't injective more broad than one-to-one?
No, these two terms are interchangeable. Yeah, at least in this concept. Which one do you know that is, what example is? Bijective is now has to do with this. This Gerkier is saying, let's.
Yes, you're right.
Yeah, so bijective is, we're going to introduce another term for that. But bijective gives you the sense that you're going in both directions. So there is a property in that. Here I'm just, one to one.
It's like one to one. Each thing has a pair. But injective means you can have like, you know, it's not necessarily.
I've seen both definitions.
Well, if it's one to one and onto, which means really? That.
Right. That you can do the inverse. Okay, so maybe with pictorially, I'm going to give you four. Just tell me which one is which. So let's do this. That. So what is this? Is this injective or surjective or onto? So this one-to-one or injective, because every element of wherever we end up in N, if this is Y, has at most one in X. We don't cover all the Y, so this is Y, or this is N, M to N. This is N, M, and so on. So we don't cover all of N, but there is only one. So any element of N has at most one from M. These ones have none, but each one of these have one. So this one, anyone wants to guess? Yes. This one? This is both, right? And this one?
Neither.
It's neither. And of course, okay, in this definition from M to N, M is a domain of phi, and N is the image of phi. Okay, let me erase here. Let me just move. Okay, so the class goes to STEM theory, right? Okay, so we've gone to 45 minutes or so. I'm gonna just call for a little break. If you want to go anywhere, otherwise my break was gonna be ask randomly a few people their names. So we start down here. So first three. Tell me your name, where you're coming from, and what do you like to do in your free time?
I'm from Turkey. I like reading books in my free time.
Cool.
I'm Tomujin or DJ. I'm from Korea. I like to read English.
Good. And then you?
I'm Atsilia. I'm from India. And in my free time, I like to read books. So maybe
good. Okay. So I'm Luis Leonard. I'm from Argentina. I like to run, but then lately I've been doing more hurting myself than running. So I have this never-ending process of running, get hurt, try to recover, get hurt again, and then rinse and repeat. All right, so we're going to be doing this every day.
Question.
Yeah.
So Lena, is that a German?
It's Swiss, but yeah, from the German side. Yeah, but I mean, South America or in the new continent, people emigrated, and then yeah, I have 75%. Well, no, 50% of my blood is Spanish. 25% is is Swiss, and they are 25% is Creole.
Interesting.
My last name is the only thing I can say in German, and I probably mispronounce it. I don't know. It's interesting to ask. It is very interesting to ask a German, what's the origin of this last name? And then they'll go on forever discussing. Okay. One second. Okay. So let's just try and build and recall some of the things we knew in Rm or Rn, or Rn, that we want to at least have some analog to the extent that we can have. And we're going to keep doing this again and again. Just keep pushing. How much can we push from our, if you want, our intuition, our knowledge in Rn into a curved manifold? Quite often, we're going to be able to do that. And at some point, we're going to stop being able. And then we're going to have to say, well, we have to live with this and how we're going to kind of come up with a strategy for living up with that deficiency, which, of course, will be a feature that you're going to turn into an advantage. But suppose, again, if you have a map from Rn to Rm to Rn, while you just picture this as a, so if this is y, so if you have coordinates y here and coordinates x here, these were maps from here to there. And then you could ask, so if the jth component of that map happened to be yj, which is a function of x1, xm, here's just a notation that just put all the members of the domain and say one of them arbitrary element in the image, then we'll say, well, this is a map given by this function. And then you could ask, is this function differentiable, how smooth it is, et cetera. And so you introduce things like this map is CP as P times P number of derivatives, or if you use the word smooth or analytic, then you say, well, I have infinite number of derivatives I can have. So associated with the map, we can define the inverse of the map, which is, well, we go from the image, is whatever is the map that corresponds to bringing each element to the element on M that took us there with phi. And we are going to say M and N are diffeomorphic. If phi is C infinity with a C with an inverse that is also C infinity. So this is in the context of Rn. But we're going to, again, keep pushing to try and get as close to these concepts as possible in the curve framework. And so this is closer to your bijective thing. And of course, any time we have, unless it's actually required that we have infinite number of derivatives, there are very few concepts that we cannot do with changing infinity to p, where p is some order. And in fact, as when we'll see, when we get to them, Einstein's equations have two derivatives of the main field, and typically we might ask only C2.
So what did you write there? Width? Is that width?
Yes, sorry. Width. So if you have a map, phi, that's C infinity, that map has an inverse, and that inverse is also C infinity, you're going to call it a diffeomorphism. And you're going to, and sometimes either the map is going to be called a diffeomorphism, or you're going to say that M and N are diffeomorphic. Okay, now let's start putting all these things together for good use. We need a few more definitions. One is an open ball in Rn. Okay, something is an open ball in Rn if there exists an open ball in Rs for a given R. I'll tell you what this R in a second, given the definition, would be all points in Rn such that x minus y is less than r, or some r and some y. So you're just saying, I have Rn. There is a y there. I'm going to draw a ball. and all points up to the boundary of that ball, we're going to call an open ball. An open set is just a collection or a union. Let's call this open ball B. It's a union of the BIs. And finally, we're getting to something you'll see why we're introducing, called a chart. Also sometimes referred to as a coordinate system. Let me start first with M, with a map phi that goes from M to Rn. Right, suppose you have a map. So before we defined maps, and these maps were general for going from some M to some N. So let's choose that N to be Rn. Right? And we're going to say if you have a map that takes this M to Rn, in principle, we're going to then have to be a little bit more careful. In principle, we can say this point in our manifold has these labels in Rn. And if we can keep doing this in a one-to-one form, we're going to say, well, any point here can be interpreted by the labels that this map provides. But of course, we have to be careful here because, well, depending on the properties of our map, we might have several of these points coming back. Sorry. Depending on where it's one-to-one or not, we might not be able to cover the whole of these. We might have multiple labels here. So we don't want to have that. So we're going to put some restrictions here. So first, we might not be able to do it with a full manifold. So let's change this to some U in M. So it's just a subset that takes us correctly to Rn. And we're also going to ask that this map is onto an invertible so that we can make sense going back and forth. So an example which you may be familiar with, let me write it here, instead of a sphere. So locally, in the sphere, we can choose this patch and have it be related to R2. Let's say this as a two sphere. But if you try to map this whole thing into R2, you end up with not being able to satisfy this uniqueness property. So usually what you need is at least two patches.
Why is that the case?
Say again?
Why is that the case?
Because of, say, that point. So you try to map. So one option is, have you ever seen the stereographic projection? OK, so the stereographic projection, right? So sends these by tangents, if you want, take those points. So the one is at southern hemisphere, you map there. The ones in northern hemisphere, you map inside. But then there is this point that goes to infinity. So you cannot have a map that is invertible that all maps the whole of the sphere onto R2. You can have, then what you do is you put more than one patch. And this is the reason why, remember in the definition of a manifold, we said it's a collection of patches where we can locally make the contact with Rn, and then we're going to have to smoothly sew them together. Okay, and finally we put all this together. And you're going to see what we're doing or why we did all this. Maybe I can do it here. So I apologize. This is kind of terse and arid territory, but soon we're going to be doing something more fun. So the last definition is an atlas, which is an index collection of charts that satisfies the union, oh, that's not going to be good. The union of all the U's is M. There will be intersections, that's fine. This is why we also define the open bolt. We don't want boundaries. So there are going to be intersections, and I'll just give you a little graph. But the union of U's is M, and the charts are, and this is something that we said before, smoothly sewn together. And what does it mean? It means that suppose you have two, and let me give you the drawing first, and then we can just add words. Why did I put it way over there? Here. Now imagine this is our manifold, M, and we have a collection of subsets U. Let's imagine this is U beta, this U alpha. Associated to this U alpha, there is a map to Rn. And of course, it doesn't map it to the full of Rn. It maps it somewhere here. From UB, there is this other map, phi B, which maps it, maps this side or that ball of into Rn again, and it might be this. But now, oh cool, I have a lot of charts. There is an intersection here. And what smoothly sewn together means is essentially this one. You can go from here to there, back to here by map composition. So if U alpha intersection U beta is non-vacuum, it's non-zero, non-trivial, then phi alpha composed to phi beta to the minus 1. And we're also saying this chart, each phi should be invertible in their domains. So this takes a point in phi b, u alpha intersection u beta, into Rn, which is in Rn, onto an open set of phi alpha, u alpha intersection u beta, which is in Rn. And all the maps are, put it this way, all maps are C infinity. Again, we can relax the C infinity to CP, but by and large, unless it's necessary, we'll just imagine this. We can take as many derivatives as we need to. So something we have to be careful with is that often in our intuition of manifolds or things like when I see a ball or when I see a circle.
Why did you define the intersection to be the?
So the idea is that.
Because you could have said that the both phi beta minus one inverse also has an effect on the entire u beta. And.
So what do you mean? Sorry.
So phi beta inverse has its effect on the entire mapping of u beta, right?
Of course, but here what we're saying is that it makes sense. So by saying it's smooth, we can go with either map to Rn, and we're still going to be fine. Or we can do the identification. So they say no. Otherwise, it wouldn't be smooth. So that's the all you're trying to do is that if you want is not to have to tile your manifold with disjoint maps. So you're allowing intersections, and when the intersections takes place, you have consistent behavior, consistent label. That's all you're doing. That's what it meant by what it's mean by this.
I think your remark is related also to the fact that the phi beta is not defined on U alpha. Oh, it's only defined the part of U alpha
on the intersection.
So that's why you need to restrict yourself to the intersection. Because otherwise, your map is not defined outside that.
Yeah, you're right.
That's right. Yeah.
But it's defined on the entire u beta. So if you had a point on u beta that is not part of the intersection of u alpha and u beta, and you
right, so you got a point here.
What happened then? Because if you start from the you calculate the effect of phi beta on the points that are not in the intersection.
So that this one.
So this map here.
Right, it might be there.
When you do the inverse, go back there, and when you take the effect of phi alpha on that.
You can't because it's not defined. I don't have a phi alpha. I don't have a phi alpha being able to act here.
No, just make it consistent with the intersection.
So let me just take one moment. This is maybe an obvious point, but just in case. When we look at the circle, we're usually able to say, oh, that circle has a curvature. And very soon we're going to start making contact with curvature. But the reason we know that is because we're appreciating it from the embedding space in which the circle lives. So the circle is a one-dimensional entity, which is now living in the two-dimensional entity that is the blackboard. We would be awfully tempted to say there is a curvature. This is extrinsic curvature. It's the way that it embedding is deformed with respect to the embedding spacetime. But if you were an ant living on the circle, and you can only experience and do experiments that are local to the circle, you wouldn't be able to tell there's a curvature. Well, same thing that happened with the humans in history when we thought, well, unfortunately, there are even people today that think that the Earth is flat, but maybe we shouldn't be calling them humans. Now, that was bad. But it's pretty annoying. Anyway, so with this, what are we able to say? And again, remember I said we're in a sense, trying to cheat a little bit. Is we're trying to map everything we know and love from Rn to our curve spacetime. The price to pay is all this extra structure, which has been introduced to say at least locally, I can think of adding a chart there, or I can think of adding coordinates. How do I add the coordinates? By suitable mappings that takes that portion of our curve manifold into the appropriate Rn. So if I have and again, in the example of the circle, I would have a map that takes us to R. In the case of the surface, say, of the sphere, will take us a map that takes us to R2. As we mentioned, we might need more than one chart, but that's OK. We just need to make sure we remember that. And with that, we're going to then introduce further things. So we want to do physics. often we have motions and, as I said, rate of change of objects, and that for that some concept that was very useful was that of vectors. And vectors, in a sense, said, well, we know of them as something that has a magnitude and a direction, right? This is what you learn in undergraduate, well, actually in high school physics, or maybe even primary school physics. But okay, you might have a magnitude, but what's the direction? Direction with respect to what? How do we even define a direction if we have a curved manifold? So we need to introduce some, if you want, augmented sense of a vector. And which initially, if you haven't seen this before, will look weird. But I promise, very slowly, you're going to start seeing that all the things that you knew from vectors are being manifested there, except that they are relaxed a little bit to understand what in the world is going on. So suppose you have a manifold, and now I'm going to define some, try to draw something that is curved. And let's imagine we're trying to look at a point and define vectors. But it's a curve. It's a curved spacetime. So what we're going to be doing is to say, well, think of any possible curve. Let's call this vector P. Think of any possible curve that goes through P. Maybe you have this one. Have this other one. Ouch. And so we're going to define a vector as something that only knows about that P. Remember, also a vector, in a sense, in our previous notion, we always said, well, take the value of something at this point and that point, and the difference is telling us what the vector is. But we're building all this because we're saying you cannot connect, you cannot say something here to something there and make a meaningful statement about that. Right? We're only able to do things that are sufficiently local. So that's what we're trying to do. So we're going to say, well, there are curves, arbitrary curves, that go through that P. We're going to define a vector as a member of a space, which we're going to denote this way, which is a tangent space on P. So it's like we're going to be putting a plane there, if you want, in 2D. So if I'm thinking again of this of the sphere, and I'm thinking of this point, I think of that plane over there. I'm thinking of all the curves that go in here, and then associated to it, we're going to have a vector that points in that direction, etc. So this is what we're trying to build now from. And so get ready for it. I'm going to give you a very complicated plot first, just to build intuition, and then everything else that comes afterwards are words to make these things that is a lot cleaner to see in pictures informal. So suppose we have a curve here in our manifold. So how would we define a curve in our manifold? And this curve is a linear, it's a one-dimensional object, right? Which we're drawing on that surface. So because it's a one-dimensional object, we might have here a one something that lives in R, say with parameter lambda. And out of that, we have a map that takes us from R into that curve. That defines our curve. Our curve is gamma of lambda. Now, forget about this one for a second. Now you have this curve, and you want to give coordinates along the curve. What have we built for that? We have built a map that goes from here. But this curve lives in whatever dimensionality that space has. So if this is a sphere, this lives in R2. So we need a map that takes us to R2, or to whatever chart we have. So let me do this. This is our phi that takes us to R, whatever, Rm. We're going to assume, now that we're going into charts, and because we're working with Atlas, that these things have inverses. So we also can make sense of the inverse, phi to the minus 1. So we want to introduce something that tells us, associated to each curve, if you want, the magnitude of that vector, or a number that is associated to each vector we can consider. So So that is a number, because it's a number, it's a map into the real. This is what our TPM, TP will be. And now our task is to put all this mess together and try and make contact with our vector. And let's call this F. So it's a map associated to that particular curve, a different curve. I have had this curve. Of course, we would have had another gamma. We would have another F if you want. It might have been a G. But let's try and use this to ask what would be, so right, again, a vector, would, we are trying to make sense of how the tangent or a concept that is tangent to that point or is, exists at that point gives us a number and is associated with, if you want, the rate of change along this curve, which we can map something that is in the neighborhood of that gamma. Is that clear? So we're trying to say, given the curve, the rate of change along that curve, extremely local to that point, this is what we're going to try and assign a vector to. So we want to say, if we take df, so how does something that varies along the curve changes upon a small variation in lambda, so this is better thought of this way. So we're in the end, we're varying here, and we're changing slightly that number that is in here. We're trying to say, what is the rate of change of that curve that we can think of as a curve that goes from R to R? Because we are going from R to R, we can use our standard intuition of differentiation along a curve. And that's what we're doing here. So first, we compose with gamma, then we compose with F, and we went from R to R. But now is when we're going to begin, again, to keep using that terminology, to cheat by saying in the middle, we're in M, and we are uncomfortable working with M, but that's where we have our chart. We're going to go to RM. So this is the same as dd lambda of F composed with F to the minus 1 compose F compose to gamma. If I consider this, I'm doing nothing. I just introduce a unity, an identity. So going somewhere and coming back, because we can go back and forth between phi and phi to the minus 1. But F, what is this? Let's just think of this, only this. This is come from wherever you are in Rm through f to the minus 1, and then go with f. So we go from Rm to f. That's our piece.
How do we know that there is always a chart?
Oh, we're now there. So a manifold, we're working with a manifold. We're postulating. We're going to work with manifolds. Manifolds have that. And so we can do this. But great. Thanks for that question.
So we still have a question.
Yes.
F is the second curve, right?
Say again?
You know, one of the curves are gamma and the other one is F, right?
Or, yes.
Okay. So like they're just defining one point together, right? Like
I'm at that point. So I'm keep thinking of the point and what happens in a very, very small local neighborhood around that.
So like all we were saying is just like in one point. It's not like
it's in one point associated to one curve. So we could be talking about this curve, or we could be talking about that curve. So we're going to have multiple vectors, and that's why we're defining TP will be a bona fide space. And it's the tangent space on the point P, which will have all the vectors associated to that point that we can define, which in turn is associated with all the curves that can go through that point in the manifold. So as opposed to so we're going to have a kind of a large structure where maybe the vector we're really interested in lives there. And the next thing we're going to do, and not today, but next class, is to remember we kept thinking, oh, in the spacetime, there are special trajectories, which are the trajectories that free falling particles will go through or will go along. We're going to try and identify in TP what's the definition what's the equation that determines that trajectory. And those will be very special trajectories, which will have their own name, which are called geodesic. We're going to get them. And out of that, we're going to slowly build towards writing Einstein equation. Then phi composed to gamma. So this is, so we're going here, we're going from gamma to Rm, we compute a derivative, and then we go from Rm to R. So that's what we're doing here. So what is this? So when in this piece, so this is, oh, this satisfies Leibniz rule, so we can apply through the derivative. So this will be, let me just do this quickly, stop here, and then I'm going to say a few more words about this next class. I'm going to put in some notation. So phi composed to gamma is what we say. Go phi and gamma. So wait, what did it? So gamma and then phi. So that's a function that goes from R to Rm. Right, so a derivative there, we know how to do that. And then it will give us m components, right? Because that's where we're going. So this is why I put an m supra index. And again, we're going to be talking more about notation and what and where these indices should be. For the moment, just think of them being up. If it's better for you, put it wherever you want. Eventually, we're going to make contact and have a very rigorous definition of where it should go. And then this one, phi to the minus 1 r, that's just the gradient of a function, right? That leaves in Rm and goes to R. And so that's the gradient of a function. And as a notation, we're going to say this is the, now let me put xm. After all, this was something that took us from here to Rm. And here we have coordinates. So let's just call coordinates x1, x2, whatever. So that's what we're saying, dxm, d lambda. So how each component in Rm varies when we change lambda ever so slightly. So that's the first piece. And this one is the derivative, is the gradient of f. So we were saying, and this is what we're kind of making contact with, our intuition told us, depending on the curve being f here, which could be arbitrary as long as it goes to the point, we're trying to make contact with that number that is associated to that point and associated to that curve. And so we could have, in this case, if the curve is parameterized so that we traverse it this way, what we're saying is, what is that little number, which we're going to say it's a vector, tangent to that point? That's the gradient. But of course, it depends also on the way we're getting to that point and our charts. And this is included here. So this is where our vector is going to be. There are a few things that we're going to call here. Let me not get there now because it's going to be too much. One thing we're going to say is we're going to ask one more property for this vector to satisfy. And that property we're going to carry through will be crucial to for us to tell this is a vector and this is not. Once we have that property, we're going to say, what's the derivative of a vector? And if we take this standard derivative, the simplest derivative we can think of, we're going to see that the result of the derivative applied to the vector to a vector is no longer something that is special. And we're going to try to fix that. And when we fix that, we're going to introduce a very special derivative. And this is called the covariant derivative. And we're off, in some sense, to the race. But this is where we're going. I'm going to stop here, I think. If you have any questions, let me know. Also, if collectively you think those options for office hours are not good, let me know. We're going to try and look for something around that might be useful for you, because I don't know what the rest of your schedule looks like. All right, thank you.